Chapter 5. The Eternal Intelligence. 250 years ago, philosopher Immanuel Kant wrote in his Critique of Pure Reason, "I should not hesitate to stake my all on the truth of the proposition that, at least, some one of the planets which we see is inhabited." Apart from the odd UFO sighting and alleged contacts with UFO crews, which as of yet have not been scientifically verified, there has been no contact during our modern age with inhabitants from other planets. So do they even exist? As early as 1950, world-famous nuclear physicist Enrico Fermi asked, "If a multitude of extraterrestrial civilizations exist out there, where are they?" Good question. Where are they? The question soon became famous the world over. It is now known as the Fermi paradox. In the English-speaking world, there is no shortage of highly scientific publications that are either pro or con on the subject of extraterrestrials. With ice-cold objectivity, they deal with questions that leave people in other parts of the world shaking their heads. You can only join in if you speak good English. It's no great surprise to me that there is no funding for ET research in the non-English-speaking parts of Europe. Maybe the English speakers are better informed, or maybe they're just more open to such things. The Fermi Paradox. Scientist William Hosek gave his opinion on the Fermi Paradox in the specialist journal JBIS, Journal of the British Interplanetary Society. And what was his scientifically based conclusion? "Consequently, humans have not and will not be visited by them, and humans will not visit other civilizations." What makes him so sure? Hosek looks at the Fermi paradox from a purely economic point of view. He assumes, and he's almost certainly right, that on every inhabited planet, the available raw materials will all get used up eventually. People, however, are not created to be long-range planners. That is to say, they don't really think beyond the span of their own lives, that is, in terms of centuries. Regardless of whether we're talking about the public or private sector, whether states or multinational companies, investments are never made with future centuries in mind because people expect to see some kind of return for their stakeholders or in time for the next election, and so on. If man ever sent a starship out to seek raw materials, those left behind would never know if the ship's crew were going to be successful or come back empty-handed. Can you imagine any institution investing maybe billions of dollars in a project with no guarantee of any return? People don't live for very long, and they want to see results. Not only that, building a gigantic generation starship, a spaceship designed for journeys longer than the lifespan of its crew, would not only cost huge amounts of money, but would itself also require great quantities of precious raw materials, just those materials, in fact, that the home planet is running short on. Logically, such raw materials cannot be risked on an incredibly expensive space adventure that won't bear fruit until hundreds of years later, if at all. Hosek applies this earthly logic to extrasolar civilizations too, and the results of his analysis are quite sobering. First, before we receive any help from an alien civilization, we would need to know the strangers and at least be in regular radio contact with them. Second, the alien civilization would need to be more advanced than ours. Third, any civilization would need to be in a position to receive our messages, translate them, and finally understand them. Fourth, they would have to be able to provide the raw materials that we are looking for. Fifth, they would have to be willing to share their technology and raw materials with us. Sixth, we would have to be capable of making use of their tools and instructions. And finally, the ETs out there would inevitably also be aware that their own raw materials are going to run out too, sometime. Therefore, it hardly seems likely that any alien civilization is going to present its valuable raw materials to any other civilization. All of this sounds fairly plausible from an economic point of view. Dr. William R. Hosek, the author of this scientific article, states quite specifically that his observations are purely economic assumptions. So we can forget future space travel because we humans want to see short-term results and simply do not have the resources to build a gigantic starship. I'll come back to this later. SETI. What about radio contact? Aren't we always reading stuff about some SETI project? SETI stands for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Aren't millions of dollars being spent every year on huge radio telescopes so that we can receive and send signals? Didn't we already send signals into space in 1960 as part of Project OSMA? Is it possible that some alien answer came long ago and is being kept secret so as to avoid mass panic among the peoples of the world? Well, the answers to all these questions are a lot more complex than they might seem at first glance. We don't know the precise wavelengths at which interstellar communication operates. The OSMA project in 1960 was carried out by a group of leading scientists in Green Bank, West Virginia. Back then, they opted for a wavelength of 21 centimeters, 8.3 inches, which corresponds to the neutral element hydrogen. Seeing as hydrogen is present throughout the entire universe, they believed that extraterrestrial civilizations would use this wavelength to communicate on. Today, we're a bit smarter than that. The 21-centimeter wavelength is extremely susceptible to interference. Out there in space, which we once presumed was completely empty, it hisses, bubbles, bangs, beeps, and crackles the whole time. There's a whole soup of noises that need to be filtered out before you could hear anything. Even before that happens, you would have to fathom out whether the signal even originates from an intelligent source or whether it's just one of those many sources of interference. Despite all these efforts, to this day, not one single radio signal has arrived from an intelligent species. The question has to be, should we send out signals? Should we be the ones to stand up and shout into space, "Hello, it's us"? Is it even possible? And how much energy would we have to use to even have a chance of being heard by someone out there? Professor George Swenson of the University of Illinois has devoted himself to this problem. Swenson is a former astronomer and an engineer. His specialties were electrical oscillations and antenna construction. Writing in the scientific journal Scientific American, Swenson analyzed the immense difficulties associated with radio astronomy. Should we direct our signals at some specific target out there in space? Home in on a particular planet? To be able to do that, we would have to know the location of a planet that is home to an intelligent species. The extraterrestrials living there would have to be ready to receive signals, have receiver antennas installed, and use a technology that was at least similar to ours. Added to this, planets do not only rotate around their own axis, but also along an elliptical orbit around their sun. How would it be possible to aim for an exact point in space from here on Earth? This is a point, let's not forget, that is several light years away from Earth, and, to be honest, we can't really know if it even exists. So we've ruled out choosing an exact point, and we decide to send out a broad signal. After all, a normal radio antenna here on Earth doesn't send its signal direct to the recipient, but rather sends out its signal in all directions. It is available to all recipients at the same time. In radio astronomy, this is known as omnidirectional, in other words, present throughout the broadcasting sector. But there's no way we could send out a signal to the entire Milky Way. The energy that would be necessary would not be available anywhere, except perhaps from a nearby neutron star. That means, then, that we would have to concentrate on a selected sector of the Milky Way. There are just two stars within 5 light-years of our solar system. Within 10 light-years, this number jumps to 12. Increase the circle to 15 light-years, and we have 39 stars, and within 50 light-years, as many as 100. Within 100 light-years, the number of stars multiplies 1,000-fold. Nowadays, we know that many of these stars have their own planets, What we don't know is whether any of these planets have Earth-like conditions or whether they can support any intelligent life. How powerful would our terrestrial transmitter have to be to send out an omnidirectional signal over a distance of 100 light-years? Professor Swenson took the trouble to work this out. In his words, the transmitter would have to have more than 7,000 times the total electricity-generating capacity of the U.S. Even using nuclear energy, that's simply not possible. What remains is the approach we have always used, to shine our little light into the darkness and hope that someone out there sees it, or that one of our receiving stations, which are technically highly developed and extremely sensitive, will someday be lucky enough to pick up some stray signal from an extraterrestrial source. There are answers. Does that put an end to every discussion on interstellar travel or radio contact with ETs? It certainly doesn't. Praise the Creator. The opinions of one group, however objective and rational they may be, will always conflict with those of another group that is equally as objective and rational. And we shouldn't forget that, according to Professor Robert Haviland of Daytona Beach, Florida, the space program is being pushed ahead for now by amateurs who have already described every aspect of interstellar travel and space research. Even the theory of relativity was developed by an amateur, a secretary in a Swiss patent office, without any backing from the state or any university. Einstein, that very patent clerk, held to the maxim that if there is a solution to this problem, then I will find it. Problems have always existed. You can find them everywhere, and, depending on the current state of knowledge, many of those who consider themselves to be rational happily declaim impossible. Others, on the other hand, start looking for solutions. This is no coincidence. In the depths of our subconscious, call it your soul, if you will, we realize that there is a solution somewhere for every impossibility. It's down to the memes or universal consciousness that I mentioned briefly in Chapter 1. More about this later. Warp drives? In November 2007, the British Interplanetary Society organized a symposium in London on the subject of the warp drive. This is a theoretical propulsion unit that would allow faster-than-light travel. The basic mathematical framework for the warp drive was worked out as early as 1994. Warp speed is reached by bending, or warping, the space-time continuum. These curvatures in space were predicted by Einstein. Now their existence has been proven. Huge heavenly bodies bend light, for instance. At the London Symposium, a number of rational mathematicians and astrophysicists talked about the expansion of the universe, about gravitational fields in the vacuum of space, and about the possibility of leaping from one bubble to another without losing time. The warp drive, the scientists agreed, would exploit our knowledge of mass, space-time, and quantum physics without contravening any of the fundamental laws of physics. Laymen may scratch their heads and cry, "Impossible!" But the fact that nothing is impossible is even alluded to by the God of the Old Testament. This is only the start of what they may do, and now it will not be possible to keep them from any purpose of theirs. Genesis chapter 11, verse 6. As early as 1984, Professor Michael Papagiannis, an astronomer at Boston University, postulated that the proliferation of a species within our Milky Way could be possible. And all this without any warp drive, which wasn't even a subject of discussion back then. According to Papagiannis, at a velocity of 2% of light speed, which is possible with the help of nuclear fusion, a spaceship will cover a distance of 10 light years in about 500 years. After this, the space colonists would need around another 500 years to industrialize a planet. That's quite plausible. After all, we needed just 200 years to progress from horse-drawn carriages to moon rockets and from the abacus to the supercomputer, and we had to invent everything from scratch. Our theoretical interstellar colonists wouldn't have to start from point zero because all the plans and fabrication methods would already be available to them. The space travelers would not need to discover how to extract raw materials from the Earth, smelt steel, produce plastics, or generate electricity. After a stop of 500 years, they could move on, either using the old mothership or in a new one of their own construction. Again, they would be in transit for 500 years, and so on. Papagiannis noted, "This means that each wave of colonization takes 1,000 years to cover roughly 10 light years, 500 years traveling and 500 years of establishment and growth. That corresponds to a speed of 1 light year per century." Colonies in space. In other words, we could colonize the entire Milky Way in 10 million years, and the only expense would be the initial starship. All of this without any warp drive. Since Papagiannis made these claims in 1983, his calculations have been updated several times. Astronomer Ian Crawford from University College in London suggests a proliferation rate of 10% of light speed and a period of 400 years between setting up a new colony and the next phase. In this way, the wave of colonization moves on at a rate of 0.02 light years per year. Seeing as the Milky Way has a diameter of approximately 100,000 light years, it will take around 5 million years to completely colonize it. 5 million years corresponds to just 0.05% of the age of the Milky Way. Are we human beings ourselves offshoots of an extraterrestrial colony without even knowing it? Impossible, cry the evolutionists. How many times is that now? It can be demonstrated conclusively that we evolved on the Earth. No contradiction, answer the problem solvers. The human race can have arisen on the Earth via the usual evolutionary routes. Absolutely. But sometime over the course of the last few thousand years, there was a targeted, artificial mutation introduced by just those ETs that are worshipped as gods, as was recorded in the ancient texts. This doesn't contradict evolution. Rather, it complements it with the creation of a symbolic Adam and Eve. But there are other ways of looking at it. Just imagine that you are sitting in an airplane that is spiraling around the Earth. The aircraft is packed full with seeds of oak trees. Every hour, you open the window and throw out a handful of seeds. Of course, you realize that a large portion of the seeds will be lost in the oceans. After all, 2/3 of the Earth's surface is covered in water. Some of them will land on sand, deserts such as Sahara, Nevada, Gobi, or Baluchistan. Yet more land on stone, and others land somewhere in the ice of the Arctic or Antarctic. Only a small proportion of the seeds that are scattered have a chance of landing on suitable terrain and then not being eaten by some rodent. That small proportion soon begins to sprout, though, and finally you have a fully grown oak tree. Maybe it will have a few mutations, but it will still be ostensibly an oak tree, because the important genetic information is already contained in the seed. Panspermia explains it all. Now transfer this model to the entire universe. The idea comes from the Swedish Nobel Prize winner Svante Arrhenius, 1859 to 1927. Arrhenius was a professor of physics at the University of Stockholm and was way ahead of his time. Somewhere, way out there in the universe, so Arrhenius theorized, the very first intelligences began to develop a long, long time ago. The question as to how this first life form arose is as unanswerable as the question, how long is a piece of string? This first intelligent race, let's call it number one, was interested in proliferating its own species throughout the universe. There are plenty of reasons for this. Just like a virus, number one sends out billions upon billions of its own germ seeds out into the cosmos, just as randomly as our seeds from the airplane. Number one knows that the majority of its building blocks for life will end up burning up in a sun, rain down on an unsuitable planet, or end up coming to naught for some other reason. Some of these building blocks will clatter down onto planets that are similar to Number One's home planet. Thus sprouts the seed of life, and, soon after, the evolution process kicks in. In science, this theory is known as panspermia, and is one logical explanation of how intelligence may spread throughout the universe, without a warp drive, without any faster-than-light speeds, and without any colonies sent out on generation starships. Building blocks from out there. The origin of life on Earth is truly a puzzle and cannot be simply explained by the existence of a primeval soup or some niche hypothesis. I have spent the last 30 years writing about the subject. In that period, more than 600 scientific publications have been published on the subject of the origin of life, and the general tenor is always the same. What we ought to remember is that evolution and the origin of life really should be treated separately. Evolution is the biological transformation of species, Darwin. The origin of life, on the other hand, happens before evolution. This is all about chemical building blocks and the physics behind it. Professor Bruno Vollmert, a macrobiologist and former director of the Polymer Institute at the University of Karlsruhe, Germany, notes, "Seeing as the macromolecular preconditions are not fulfilled, the neo-Darwinism prevalent today is untenable as a scientific hypothesis." Sir Fred Hoyle, for many years professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of Cambridge, is of the same opinion. In pre-Copernican times, the Earth was wrongly considered to be the geometric and physical center of the universe. These days, even respectable scientists still regard the Earth as the biological center of the universe, an almost unbelievable repetition of the same earlier mistake. The only possible explanation for evolution is if the genetic material, necessary for the origin of life, came from somewhere outside of our system, in other words, from somewhere completely different. Together with mathematical genius Professor Wickramasinghe from Cardiff University, Wales, Sir Fred Hoyle published a book called Life Cloud, The Origin of Life in the Universe. The two academics' findings can be summed up in the following statement. There was never any home development stage here on Earth. Life had already developed to a relatively high information content before the Earth was even there. By the time we received life, all of the basic biological questions had already been answered. It goes on like this. I know the treatises. Even the dyed-in-the-wool supporters of the birth of life on Earth, like Dr. David Horn, professor of anthropology at Colorado State University, admit today that my books have given them serious cause for thought. Even Professor Horn now agrees, life arrived here from outer space. Why do we keep twisting and turning and trying to reject this sensible and scientifically provable standpoint? The thought that we are not the apotheosis of creation or the pinnacle of evolution really goes against the grain for some people. We like to think of ourselves as the best thing in the galaxy. Pure egocentricity, I'd like to add. The Earth was never a closed system. We were and still are unequivocally bound to the universe, a fact, by the way, that is an intrinsic part of many of our holy books. And God made man in his image, Genesis chapter 1, verse 27. But what do we care about holy books? The Church and ETs. In the year 1600, Dominican monk Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake for uttering the monstrous idea that intelligent life may exist elsewhere in the universe. 400 years later, the Pontifical Culture Commission declared this execution to be unlawful. The Catholic Church has fundamentally changed its stance, and it's mainly down to two Jesuits, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, 1881-1955, and José Gabriel Fuentes, 1963. The latter is an Argentinian and has been the director of the Vatican Observatory Speculo Vaticana since August 2006. A total of 12 Jesuits, I call them the Papal Guard of Intelligence, look after the telescopes and the Zeiss astrographs on the roof of Castel Gandolfo. The Jesuits were always the forward thinkers of the Catholic Church. They make sure that the Roman Curia doesn't get stuck in the Middle Ages and also do their bit to ensure that the fame of the Jesuits extends beyond the Earth. As a result, 30 lunar craters carry the name of Jesuit astronomers. Foremost among these forward thinkers was philosopher and Jesuit priest Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. He recognized that there was a clear link between man and the cosmos. The fundamental building block of matter is the atom, and that applies all throughout the universe. Atoms themselves consist of a nucleus and subatomic particles, and they are not simply there. They are subject to vibrations. Elementary particles, I mentioned this in Chapter 1, did not acquire their strange and baffling characteristics from nowhere, but from their interaction with other particles. The word itself says it. A particle is a part of something else, and the whole is reflected in every constituent particle. Teilhard de Chardin was already talking about this back in 1949. His term Aleph covers everything, the Alpha and the Omega, and this includes cause and effect. Even his Jesuit brethren found Teilhard de Chardin a little bit uncanny. In 1962, 7 years after his death, the Catholic Church decided, following years of hefty theological arguments, that Teilhard's views contradicted Christian teachings. As astrophysicists today know, however, Teilhard de Chardin was perfectly right, just like Giordano Bruno all those centuries previously. José Gabriel Fuentes, director of the Vatican Observatory, no longer has to struggle against such antiquated and outdated opinions. In an interview in the Vatican journal L'Osservatore Romano, he was asked his opinion on the possibility of extraterrestrial life. His answer: in the same way that there are a large number of creatures on the Earth, there could also be other life forms, even intelligent ones, that were also created by God. This does not conflict with our faith, because we may not set limits on God's creative freedom. As St. Francis might say, if we look at the earthly creations as brothers and sisters, why can't we also talk about an extraterrestrial brother? He would, after all, also be part of creation. Required forms. Evolution is truly a buzzword of our times. Down here on Earth, it is at least, with a few exceptions, demonstrable. But evolution is also universal. We are just a microscopic sideshow in cosmic evolution. This evolution has required forms, whether it's here on Earth or any place else, and whether on a minute scale or a massive scale. Required forms on a small scale can be things like the fact that the brain of any intelligent species is always in the immediate vicinity of the eyes, for example. It has to be like that, because this is the quickest route for the neurons. As soon as the eye sees something, the brain reacts. Or every nose, proboscis, trunk, or other olfactory organ is located not far from the mouth. You need to smell something before you eat it. Of the grasping tools, arms, hands, tentacles, and so forth, at least one is always aligned to the front. After all, you need to see what you touch. We humans all believe that we've got something that we call free will. It's true when it comes to trivial everyday things, but not when it comes to anything important. Just try to do anything to stop curiosity. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that dolphins are highly intelligent life forms. At night, while jumping out of the water, they observe small lights in varying degrees of brightness and different colors twinkling in the firmament. The Dolphin Council swims together to discuss the question, is there anything out there? Are there other kinds of dolphins, maybe? Sooner or later, in evolutionary terms, it's not so important when, the dolphins decide to attempt interstellar travel to find the answer to this burning question. Space travel is not possible to a non-metallic culture. To blend and cast metals, you need fire. To make fire, you need to get out of the water. Required forms. Evolution, mutation, and selection are everyday occurrences in the universe. Solar systems and planetary systems are formed. Some of them are well suited for the transportation of panspermia. Others are not so ideal. Selection. Astrophysicists ask themselves, what happened before the Big Bang? Practically all of them use the concept of a singularity, which was the state before the Big Bang happened, around 14 billion years ago. But where did this singularity come from? Something appearing from nothing, that's certainly anything but scientific. One solution for this dilemma is loop quantum gravity, or LQV. According to this theory, space consists of space quanta, which are comparable to the little hills you might find on a ski piste. The skier doesn't bash his way through these. He has to adjust to them, just like time. Quantum gravitation theory precludes the existence of so-called wormholes in space. Space-time does not consist of strings or atoms of space-time, but a region of infinite boredom. The structure found just below the threshold will simply repeat itself on every smaller scale, ad infinitum. We Joe Publics can't really picture it. After all, space quanta measure just one Planck length. That's something like a billionth of a trillionth of a centimeter. The important thing is to realize that this loop quantum gravitation can be used to get around the singularity, the nothing before the Big Bang. The result is no longer a Big Bang, but rather a big bounce. Another universe existed before our Big Bang. Our Big Bang was, in fact, the death knell of a previous universe, and so it goes on for eternity. It still begs the question, of course, when did all this start? That's one that nobody's going to be able to answer in a hurry. We're getting closer to the vibrations, the oscillations that can be found in all matter. I would like to take the liberty to call these fundamental vibrations the great spirit of creation. Others might use the word God. Omnipresent memes. The proliferation of vibrations and matter through the universe can be proven, and with them, the existence of memes. Two things shape us. The gene is a fundamental biological component. We originated and still function on a genetic basis. The meme, on the other hand, influences our consciousness. It is present everywhere and at every possible time, past, present, and future, and acts in a similar fashion to a virus. A virus is not a true life form, by the way it needs another life form to reproduce. Memes, too, are not life forms. They need our brains to propagate them. This functions, curiously enough, according to the same selection process as in evolution. Let me illustrate with an example. You, my dear reader, are listening to this audiobook. The ideas in it may excite you. You may agree with them or disagree. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, that you are an enthusiastic recipient of the content of this audiobook and you recommend it to others. They are infected by your thought processes, listen to the audiobook themselves, and encourage others to listen to it. A wave of approval for the audiobook spreads out, or we go the other way and spread negative propaganda. This in turn causes people not to buy the audiobook, and our little wave is stopped in its tracks. A kind of natural selection has taken place. This happens every day in our society. A rumor spreads or dies out. The same applies to jokes or information. Either it takes hold, in other words, it is considered interesting, clever, or important, or it dissolves into nothing. What is interesting can also be the start signal for further research, which, in itself, can be the starting point for yet more investigations. Examples include human knowledge about astronomy from the Stone Age to the present day, and mathematics from counting on fingers to the supercomputer. Memes multiply, but only when it's worth the effort. Selection again. The information must be interesting and important, fascinating and stimulating. Only then, when all minds are infected, does the world of scientific research really kick into gear. The driving force is curiosity, that beast that never stops asking questions. The proliferation of memes, the multiplication of thoughts, brings every intelligent species inevitably to a stage where it begins researching the realm of space. Why? Because at some time, most of the questions regarding earthly matters have been answered. Then all eyes turn away from the Earth and toward the next dimension. It's a compulsion. Anyone who argues that the proliferation of information within human society is the most normal thing in the world and we don't need any memes to achieve this most likely hasn't got a clue what these vibrations are capable of. Animals that find food at a certain location share this information with their fellows via a kind of thought transferal process. Are these memes? It has been clearly demonstrated among various species of birds, such as crows and vultures. The information in the gray cells in our skulls is networked and transmitted via electrical impulses. These in themselves are vibrations. What they lead to is consciousness. Consciousness is just as unmeasurable as phenomena like love, but it exists and it vibrates. Anyone who has ever fallen in love knows that the feeling persists even when his or her partner is not there. So it's not just simply about chemical responses in the body. It's about what causes those chemical reactions in the first place. The chemicals in the body, the chains of molecules, do not just start reacting without reason. Without information from the eyes, the taste organs, the emotions, and, at the end of the response chain, the brain, sex hormones won't even be sent out on their journey around the body. The electrons within us, subatomic particles, vibrate at a rate of 10 to the power of 23 times per second. It's been measured. And give off information in the process. How does that work? In the same way that atoms take on energy, that is, via minuscule vibrations caused by electrical energy, the electron leaves its mother atom quick as a flash and jumps into a nearby atom. Because the charge of an atom always has to remain constant, though, in the very same billionth of a second, an electron from this neighboring atom jumps into the gap left by the first electron following its escape. The two electrons race toward each other, without ever touching, and then part as each electron takes up the vacant position left by its fellow, orbiting around the atomic nucleus. This is because electrons repel each other. Each electron is driven by a power that, at the same time, keeps it apart from all the others. In passing, though, the electrons exchange information. How does that happen? Black photons, massless light quanta with extremely short wavelengths, exchange radiation with the black photons of other electrons. This can be measured by the so-called Schwarzschild radiation, named after astronomer Karl Schwarzschild, 1873-1916. The important thing during these thought processes is the fact that the electron is immortal, unlike other particles that puff out into nothingness after a short time. The electron has always been a stable particle. It has existed since the creation of the universe. Electrons penetrated, and still penetrate, the earth, every stone, every plant, and everything carries some kind of information. Bodies die and decay. The electron lives on and transports endless knowledge in relays from the past into the future, and vice versa. Wow! How? Just like in a black hole, electron time also runs backward. The electron knows events that lie far in the future or deep in the past. The electron was always there. French nuclear physicist Jean Charon said of the electron's amazing properties, "All matter used in the building of a living or thinking structure, and which possessed its qualities of consciousness during that structure's relatively short lifespan, cannot simply return to its original, diffuse, minimal state after the structure has died. Information, once collected, can never again be lost. No power in the world can ever cause the regression of an elementary particle consciousness after the death of a complex, organized structure. The Big Bang that kick-started our universe already contained the entire gamut of vibrations, information, from the previous universe, from its final Big Bang. Matter, which is comprised solely of atoms and their subatomic particles, arose from these vibrations. This included the electrons that jump untiringly from one atom to the next, collecting information and moving on. We live in an iridescent world of vibrations. The entire universe is filled with these vibrations, and we are part of all this. As thinking and acting beings, we create vibrations in matter. We think it is possible to build a house, and we build one. Thoughts become matter. We ponder about the feasibility and rationality of space travel, and then we develop plans for a starship. We are the doers. We implement the vibrations. A tree or a head of lettuce is no more in a position to do this than a crocodile or an anteater. They, like any piece of hard rock, are made of just the same original matter, atoms and their electrons. Vibrations, though, are in a position to develop reason, deductive capabilities, and consciousness, and the ability to form matter in a conscious, targeted manner, hands, tools, machines, and so forth. They will do it first out of a desire for comfort, houses, clothing, washing machines, vehicles, and then for knowledge. Knowledge wants to expand. Curiosity knows no rest, and every intelligence wants to go out into space. Knowledge wants to spread and multiply. The poor lettuce, on the other hand, has no organs of implementation with which it could pass on the knowledge inherent in its electrons. The memes act like viruses that infect us. They are a kind of information medium that flashes messages from one brain to another. They infect the brains of other beings and are filed away for later use. Then they can be called up when necessary, or possibly to infect other brains. A fascinating method of self-propagation. I am neither an esoteric nor a fan of those sensitive people known as mediums who are always telling us that they are able to contact another plane of existence. Maybe I should pay more attention to them and find out a bit more about the world of mediums. My reasoning intellect resists, however, for the simple reason that I always look for material evidence, and my life is just too short for me to start traveling completely new paths. My subconscious, on the other hand, knows that nothing is impossible, even those things that honest and genuine mediums want to tell me. Dr. Heinke Sudhoff is one such medium who claims she can tap the spirit of the universe. The result is a series of insights such as these. In the beginning, before consciousness, there was just spirit, the spirit of the Great One. There was no space and no time, just emptiness, in which all forms existed as possibilities, in which everything was laid out as vibrations and energy. Dr. Sudhoff claims to have received this message from the vibrations of the universe. Is she a theoretical physicist with a deep knowledge of subatomic particles and the properties of electrons? Not at all. She studied archaeology in English and knows as much about theoretical physics as any other layperson. There is, she writes, something like a holotropic state of consciousness in which one can experience the unity of the universe as an indivisible whole. And she talks of a state of bliss, which I personally have also experienced. Let me assure you here, dear listener, that I have never taken drugs, but could never put into words, certainly not in any scientific form. If you're interested, read my novel, Tommy und der Planet der Luge. In other words, maybe we don't need to resort to interstellar travel, use up our valuable raw materials, or build expensive radio telescopes, and we certainly don't have to send out waves of colonists into space. All the knowledge we could ever need is right at our fingertips, hidden somewhere in every electron. We simply need to find a way of getting to it. Space travel, to be on the safe side. If we had access to the entire knowledge of the universe, we would be almost divine. If individual people ever achieved this level of insight, maybe old monks sitting in their cells, they would never be able to put it into words. There are no words for the unthinkable. We are all transitory beings. Our intellects and our psyches demand material confirmation. Proof comes from seeing and touching. No message from a saint or announcement from a medium could ever be enough for us. Belief in something proclaimed by someone else is just not scientific. If we were to believe instead of know, we would have just the sort of chaos wreaked by religions the world over. It's no secret that every religion in our earthly madhouse maintains that it is the only one that preaches the genuine truth. Faith creates fear and insecurity. Nobody knows whether other people's proclamations are holy or just seem that way. Secretly, we are all looking for perfection, but not via belief. Faith is an artificial construct, a must that doesn't satisfy curiosity. Knowledge demands facts. In other words, despite the cosmic consciousness, despite the memes, and despite the hints of a grandiose infinitude, we will continue to search for proof. These proofs have to be material, accessible, and visible to satisfy those who are uncertain. Every doubt wants reality. This level of certainty will not arise until we have our first contact with an extraterrestrial civilization. Hurrah! That's happened already! Among the possibilities for interstellar encounters we've mentioned so far, the only thing that's missing is a von Neumann machine. What's one of those? A von Neumann machine is a technical device capable of self-replication. Humanity sends a von Neumann machine out into the next solar system. Once there, it seeks out suitable planets and starts to produce copies of itself. Then, two von Neumann machines start out, then four, then eight, and so on. It creates a kind of snowball effect, and within a calculable time frame, depending on velocities involved, our whole galaxy would be infected with von Neumann machines. These wouldn't need to be huge devices. A device the size of a macromolecule riding on the tip of a laser beam would be enough. Extraterrestrials? Contact with them? One of today's most brilliant forward thinkers in this respect is Professor Michio Kaku, a physicist at City University in New York. Following a lecture in Switzerland, Kaku was interviewed by the astronomer Dr. Stefan Thiessen. He wanted to know how we should understand the term cosmic evolution. According to Kaku, when the time comes for us to head off into space, we will have nanotechnology at our disposal, which will help us cope with the rough conditions of the extreme reaches of outer space. If we actually do meet up with some other civilization out there in space, then these beings might be part organic, part computer. Even the starships themselves could be living organisms. Professor Freeman Dyson wrote about astrochickens, a kind of genetically enhanced intelligent starship which uses chicken technology to replicate itself, i.e., lay eggs. Professor Kaku subdivides extraterrestrial civilizations into various types or categories. We belong to Type 0, which is the most primitive of all the galactic families. Type 1 is already advanced enough to have stopped warring and is capable of deploying resources globally. Type 2 is a space-traveling civilization uses unimaginable energies directly from the hearts of stars and is already colonizing the galaxy. Type 3 civilizations are, from our human perspective, godlike. They can do pretty much what they want to, where they want to. Alluding to the Fermi paradox, Dr. Thiessen asked whether Type 3 civilizations would even be interested in communicating with less developed species. Professor Kaku's opinion is, well, I would assume that they would be interested and therefore want to make contact with other civilizations. Having said that, for a Type 3 civilization, we would be little more than ants, so the level of contact would be rather limited. During the conversation, Professor Kaku also claimed that Type 3 civilizations could have sent spies out into the universe, in other words, small units that would send back word when they discovered other civilizations. Making full use of nanotechnology, these spies could be no bigger than a breadbasket, or even smaller. It's even possible that extraterrestrial spies have already been watching us for thousands of years, and we simply do not recognize them. A spy could be a stone, a computer, or even a person. We all carry information about the past right up to the present within us. The electrons ensure that the message is passed on, even out into the universe. Judgment Day. Our current knowledge about cosmic physics is still in its infancy. Astrophysicists have measured the amount of dark matter in space and discovered that there is 5 times as much dark matter as normal matter, but nobody knows what it is. They have the same problem with dark energy. It seems to be completely immaterial and yet contains around 3 times as much energy as the ominous dark matter. A massive 77% of the universe consists of dark matter, so is it any great surprise that, faced with these invisible and yet measurable dimensions, astrophysicists start thinking about parallel worlds, worlds that exist alongside ours and whose existence we barely suspect, at best? Maybe some invisible brother is looking over my shoulder right now and, again, maybe, supplying me with information. One thing is certain. At some stage, we will have contact with an extraterrestrial life form. This meeting will be Judgment Day for the world's religions. All religions are basically intolerant, even when many of their followers claim to be otherwise. Despite all the talk of conciliation and all the alleged understanding for those of other faiths, at the end of the day, the most important thing that remains is each religion's claim that only it professes the absolute truth. If this truth disappears in a puff of smoke, then what remains for the religions? Christians cannot suddenly claim that the word of Jesus in the Gospels is false. After all, it's all supposed to come directly from the Son of God. In just the same way, Muslims cannot turn around and say that the texts in the Holy Quran did not originate with the founder of their religion. Added to this, the followers of the Jewish world religion claim to be the chosen ones, and for Muslims, anyone who believes differently is an infidel. Ultimately, the believers of all 3 major Semitic religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, think they are in sole possession of the absolute truth. They must all dread the day when we finally encounter extraterrestrials. Is this perhaps a hidden reason for a certain tendency among them to exhibit no small degree of animosity towards science? A religion that ignores scientific findings and keeps scientific evidence from its followers is dogmatic. In other words, conflict with the ETs is inevitable. Religious cantankerousness and the superior knowledge of the extraterrestrials are hardly an ideal mix. What if it were the other way round? Ask well-meaning critics. What if we humans really are numero uno in the universe? If we really are the first intelligent life form? If all the projects that I've outlined here, from the von Neumann machines and the warp drive to panspermia, originated solely with us? Sometime in the next couple of centuries, perhaps. This way of thinking would be all right, but for the fact the ETs have already visited the Earth at least one time already. I know the names and traits of some of the aliens that communicated with selected humans many thousands of years ago. How do I know that? Did I have some kind of epiphany? Did some spirit whisper them into my ears, or was I infected by some kind of memes? Nonsense. Anyone who wants to know the names of the ETs can read them in the Book of Enoch. I wrote extensively about Enoch in my last book, History is Wrong. So what do we do with this knowledge? Nothing. Knowledge for the Hens. Everyone knows the famous stone circle Stonehenge in the south of England. What's that got to do with extraterrestrials? By the order of his monarch, King Charles I, 1600 to 1649, court architect and surveyor Inigo Jones, 1573 to 1652, did an extensive survey of Stonehenge, looking closely at the ancient records. He found out that the stone circle was erected to honor the god Coelus. In his report to the king, Jones wrote, "I conceive it not be impertinent to our purpose in hand to deliver what the ancients have reported of Coelus. He which first reigned over the Atlantide was Coelus. He invented men living dispersedly throughout the fields to convene and dwell in companies together, exhorting them to build towns and reducing them from wild and savage is to the conversation of civil life. Taught them also how to sow corn and seeds. He was a diligent observer of the stars and foretold men diverse things to come. According to the course of the sun, he divided the year into months. Whereby many ignorant of the perpetual course of the stars and amazed at his future predictions did verily believe that he participate of divine nature, they conferred on him immortal honors and adored him as a god. And, as he appeared, called him Coelus in regard of his skill in the celestial bodies. All of these stones erected in antiquity are like symbolic flames with which the heavens were honored. In this antiquity, many stones were put together in imitation of a constellation of stars which appear to us in the sky in the form of a circle called the Heavenly Crown. It is not improbable that Stonehenge was so composed because it was dedicated to this god, Coelus." Was information like this ever taken seriously by anybody? Just 100 years ago, academics compared this culture bringer who descended from the heavens with some kind of anthropomorphized natural elemental. The perception of sun and moon played a decisive role in the confused heads of our forefathers, I read. Undoubtedly, the beings who taught the skills of crops and tools had a lunar nature, as they just as quickly waxed, waned, or fragmented, just like the phases of the moon. With this way of looking at things, it's no wonder that beard and head hairs become rays of sun, and the heavenly teachers become stars, which admittedly also can appear and then disappear. These quotes are hundreds of years old, but little has changed. We still cling to the dated templates from psychologists, and in the process, consider ourselves to be well-educated. I admit that I have a certain degree of respect for the interpretations of earlier centuries. Today, is it really still necessary to keep on peddling this nonsense as scientific to students and the faithful of the many different religions? And from which divine mouths are the precise information about the calendars, the leap years, and the names of the extraterrestrials supposed to have come from in these psychologically motivated notions? Those that were written down thousands of years ago. Pumapunku, which I talked about in Chapter 1, is the real McCoy. It's verifiable. For that reason alone, we should stop letting the establishment lead us around by the nose. Maybe then we'll be in a better position to cope with the return of the gods. This concludes Twilight of the Gods. Tantor Audio is proud to present a bonus interview with author Eric von Daniken.
Eric von Daniken's first book, Chariots of the Gods, became a worldwide bestseller following its publication in 1968 and has been translated into 32 languages. Tantor Audio is very pleased to be releasing for the first time on audio four of Mr. von Daniken's books, Chariots of the Gods, Twilight of the Gods, The Eyes of the Sphinx, and History is Wrong. And we are very honored to have Mr. von Daniken with us today as our guest. Welcome, Mr. von Daniken.
Well, welcome myself. Happy to be with you on the phone.
Thank you so much. Now, of course, you are the Swiss author best known for your claims about extraterrestrial influences. And this is a topic that has really been popular since 1968, since your very first book, Chariots of the Gods. And, of course, we've had movies and a television series, and there's a current series on History Channel now about ancient aliens. And all of this can be attributed to your early work. And so I was wondering if you could tell the listeners, what was it? What were your earliest experiences, and at what age did you first have the feeling about these ancient aliens?
I was educated in Switzerland. I am Swiss. And I was educated for 6 years in a Swiss boarding school led by Jesuits. So I was a strict Catholic. And in my boarding school, we had also to learn Latin and Greek. And we had to make translations for some parts of the Old Testament of the Bible. Now, you have to understand, I was a very, very deep believer in God. By the way, I am still a deep believer in God. I'm one of these persons who still pray. But for me, as a young man, God had to have a few minimal qualities. For example, God would never make mistake, or God would never use a vehicle to move from one point to the other, because God is all over. We say he's omnipotent, etc. Now, by making translations from the Bible, especially from the book of the prophet Ezekiel, I had of a certain doubt in my own religious education, because the prophet Ezekiel describes, by the way, in the first person as an eyewitness, he describes a vehicle who descends from the sky. He describes the wheel of the vehicle, the wings of the vehicle. He describes the noise which the vehicle makes, etc. He calls all this the splendorness of God. Now, of course, as a young man, I asked my professors, what's this all about? And the professor said, well, Eric, you have to consider this as a vision. Ezekiel had a vision. But I could not believe in the vision because it was too natural, the explanation. So I simply wanted to know if other communities in antiquity also have similar stories like the ones we find in the Bible. And so I started to research. And finally, I came up with a hypothesis, or with a speculation, if you wish, that our ancestors must have seen some extraterrestrials long, long time ago. Now, at that time, our ancestors were Stone Age people. They could not understand what was going on. So they believed, of course, erroneously, they believed that these extraterrestrials were some kind of gods. We all know that there is only one God. But that was the misunderstanding in the past, and that's how it all started.
It's almost 50 years since the publication of your first book. Why is this still capturing the imagination of young people and older people?
Because so many things have changed in the past 50 years. You see, after Chariots of the Gods, I was, for example, attacked by some of the scientific community. They say this is all ridiculous, because no extraterrestrial, even if they would exist, they would never be able to visit us, because there are distances with the speed of light, and the next stars are far away, so they could never reach us. In the meantime, we see quite possibilities how interstellar space travel would be possible. Or I speculated at that time that some of these gods made some genetic experiments with our ancestors. Of course, I was ridiculed. In the meantime, we know that such genetic experiments are possible. Our genetics are doing it every day. And so on, the situation has changed completely. also, I know and we know much more of the old texts today than we knew 50 years ago. So many new old texts have been found in ruins all over the world. And this is my speciality, to find it and if possible to translate it. And if I'm not able to translate it, so I hire some professors who make translations. You see, in the beginning, in the old texts, we always hear, for example, that some humans, some of our forefathers, were taken into the heaven. Now the word heaven, in the religious sense, means a place of happiness, a place where you are united with God, with the Lord, after death. In the meantime, we understand that the word heaven in ancient texts was not just a religious meaning. Heaven was also space. So space is not the same thing as heaven. You see, the sky is up there. Some of our ancestors were taken into the sky and were brought back.
You have over 24 books, and they've been translated into 20 or more languages. Can you tell us, are you working on any books currently?
Of course, I'm always working. You see, I have a very big archive, and in my archive, I have about 60,000 pictures, which I made over the last 50 years worldwide. And at the moment, I'm working on 5 volumes of a picture book. Every volume has just 200 pictures, so with 5 volumes, we will have altogether 1,000 pictures. I show the most incredible things in archaeology which exists around the world.
Before we end our conversation today, I think my son, who is a big fan of yours and of ancient aliens, would like me to ask you, what do you think is going to happen in 2012?
The Maya calendar has a starting date. And the starting date of the Maya calendar, if we translate it into our Christian calendar, is August 14th, 3114 BC. That was the starting point of the Maya calendar. Now, every normal calendar has no ending date. For example, in our Christian calendar, we can go on and count and count. We can say, now it's September 2014 or so on. Not in the Maya calendar. The Maya calendar has an ending date, and you can translate the ending date into our calendar, and out comes December 23rd, 2012. Then the Maya calendar ends. Now we have Maya writings, even in some stone pyramids, where they say, at that date, a god with the name Bolon Yokte, that's the name of one of these gods, Bolon Yokte will return to Earth. So that would mean that on December 23rd, 2012, some extraterrestrials would return to Earth. Fantastic. The only problem we have is the calculation of the calendar. The specialists in Maya language, Maya astronomy, have calculated the starting point, as I said before, to August 14, 3114 BC. If this translation into our calendar is wrong, then the end date, 2012, will be wrong too. So we have traditions of the Maya which says some of the gods will return, but I would never count on the date. They will return one day, but if this will be in December 2012 or later or maybe earlier, nobody knows.
Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers, or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog.